to, next time we meet, get into the actual stuff. Give us some things that we could actually use in our dealings with other people and stuff that could even encourage our hearts as well. We want to begin classical apologetics next week and just talk about how we can deal with atheists and other types of skeptics like that. And then the rest of the course will be that way. It'll be all about, it'll just be a funneling of information that we can use. Otherwise, the thing will last forever. This really is the most difficult discipline within the realm of theology. I was showing Lou a little bit earlier. This is, you see how big this thing is? It's called Van Til's Apologetics, a Reading Analysis. It's by Dr. Greg Bonson, who was his disciple. And this is just a commentary to try to explain what Van Til was all about in his presuppositional approach. So you can see how unbelievably, I mean, this stuff is like, you know, for world-class geniuses. Or you can put the cookies way, way down on the level that hopefully I'm trying to do here. And but you can't get away with some of the, you can't get away from talking about some of the vocabulary and things like that. Anyway, if you have your outlines with you, please bring them with you. And next week I'll have a whole new set of outlines for you. But we're looking at Roman number 6, biblical case for the task of apologetics. Biblical case for the task. And what you see on your outline there, if you have it with you, is half a dozen scriptures that basically show a sixfold usage of apologetics, exactly how the thing comes to into being. What it does is it proves that the Paul and Jesus and Peter and other people believed in this, and because it's in the scriptures. Anyway, let's just review where we began with this last time. We looked at Acts chapter 17, verses 1 through 4. It says there, in 3 Sabbath days, the Apostle Paul reasoned with them out of the scriptures, opening and alleging. All right, so there was this intellectual or meshing of the minds with the apostle trying to convince these people about the gospel. And actually, in the first 4 verses of Acts 17, he is talking to Jews in Thessalonica. And so he gets right to the quick. He takes them right to the scriptures because that's where, that's what they were used to. The word reason there has to do with dialogue. He didn't just preach at them, not this time. He actually did reason with them in the scriptures. He didn't use any of the devices that might be used in the realm of logic and reasoning or evidences. He just took them right to the Bible and tried to show them and reason with them, show them the rationality of how logical the scripture actually, the gospel actually is. Then the next one we looked at was Acts 17, verses 22 through 34, where Paul is now in a predominantly Gentile context there in Mars Hill. And you'll notice it says, whereof he hath given assurance. The word there is proof. He gave proofs unto all men in that he hath raised him from the dead. The resurrection itself becoming a huge apologetic show the reasonability of a man's need to believe the gospel. And of course, Paul is dealing with Greeks there at Mars Hill, and so he actually mentions their religion. He says, I saw this ridiculous statue to this unknown God, and then he's trying to debunk that while showing the rationality of the gospel. He talks about their Greek philosophers, and so he's incorporating some of these other methodologies with pagans, with non-Jews. All right, we ended there last time. We're going to pick it up now in number C, letter C, over in Acts chapter 26. And again, we have a fairly long section there, but in Acts chapter 26, the Apostle Paul is making a legal defense. In fact, we actually have the word apologia in verse 2 of chapter 26. Can you pick it out? He says, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall apologize. I shall apologia. It's translated answer for myself this day. So he's setting forth a defense. He's actually on trial. He's defending himself. And our word, our theological word, is actually appears there in verse 2. But I'm skipping down to verse 24. And you'll notice in verse 25. But he said, I am not mad. He's been accused by Festus of being out of his mind. He says, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. Soberness there refers to reasonability. What I'm saying is far more rational and reasonable than any pagan has ever thought of. And Paul was certainly capable of embarrassing any pagan on that level if that would have been his desire, and of course it wasn't. So he's making this legal defense against the accusations of the Jews. He's appearing before the Roman governor, a man named Festus, and Agrippa happens to be in the hearing. He's in the room too. So he's got two kings in front of him, Agrippa being the son of Herod Agrippa, who had reigned during the Lord's ministry and who was presiding over the execution of Jesus. So he explains the gospel to Festus, and after he does that, he's able to say that his words were both true and reasonable. All right, he's appealing to Festus to listen to the message, both because it was true and because it made sense. He's trying to hammer to him, this is not some wild thing. This is not you, like you going out to Mars Hill and listening to some, you know, some new thing under the sun on every other day. This is a very sobering, sensible presentation that I just made to you. There was no contradiction in the apostle's mind between the gospel and between the reasonability of the gospel, right? He just proclaimed the message of the Lord using sound arguments that would make sense really to anybody who objectively would admit that it makes sense. And that's what apologetics does, especially in a scene like that. It wants to show that not only is the Christian message true, it's the only message that's true, but that it's also reasonable, both in terms of its internal logical coherence and its power to explain the world and what we're doing here. What is man doing here, you see, our experience within the world? During that very same encounter, while he's on trial, Paul is turning to Agrippa. That must have been some amazing scene. I mean, his major correspondence is with Festus. Agrippa's over here to the side, and at some point in the conversation, Paul turns his head and directly addresses Agrippa. I bet Agrippa's heart just sank, you know, because Agrippa knew. Agrippa's the one that eventually visited Paul in prison and said, I'm interested, I want to hear more. But Agrippa was there, and he asked him, he said, Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? You know, I know you do, he says. And Agrippa felt that Paul was trying to almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. But the key apologetic argument for Paul, as we've already seen in Acts, the first four verses of Acts 17, particularly amongst the Jews, was that Christianity fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies, Agrippa, that you knew from a child. See, that was his argument there. These prophecies had to have a fulfillment. I have good news. The one that fulfilled them has come. And that was his argument there. That was a very important line of argument, really, for the second century apologists like Justin Martyr and those guys. And it really is a major issue today, if anybody's going to do apologetics. All right, down to Roman number D, and it may never have occurred to you, and I certainly didn't mention it when we were going over the Romans, but chapters 1 and 2 are an apologetic to Gentiles as well. Chapter 1, verses 18 through 20, and then chapter 2, verses 14 through 15. Those are two passages that are of critical importance, because what these do now is they lay down the foundation for the classical approach to this discipline, apologetics. What Paul's doing is he's speaking of two kinds of testimony that are available even to people that have never heard one syllable of gospel or who have never laid their eyes on a Bible, okay? And of course, we call them general revelation. since they're available to everybody, contrasted with special revelation, which is only in the scriptures, all right, and particularly the gospel, which some have heard. So the two witnesses that Paul is employing in Romans 1 and Romans 2 are first creation. Creation becomes a major apologetic. That's why these creationists devoted their lives to trying to convince people that God is the creator of the earth, you see. But in Romans 1:18 through 20, Paul is mentioning things like the fact that God has invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature. All those things are seen in the things that he had made, you see. And the apostle's not claiming that that people can know everything that can possibly be known about God just by looking at creation. He's not saying that at all. But he's saying that some things about him can be known, though. You can certainly establish that he exists from doing that. And most importantly, it's possible, it's logical to know from creation that God actually is. And we can also say some things about what he's like. For example, I look at some of the amazing things in the earth, especially out here in the Western United States, and I can conclude some things about what God is like. Like, he is unbelievably intelligent. It takes a tremendous mind to make these kind of things, especially in living creatures, animal life, insect life. God is rational. There's law and order to the things he's made. He is unbelievably powerful. In fact, God is even capable of relationships because some of his creatures actually enact relationships. And so as a result of all these things that can be observed in the realm of special natural revelation or general revelation, the conclusion in verse 20 of Romans 1 is that men are without excuse. Literally, without a, and the word there is a apology, without a defense. They don't have a defense, okay? So Paul continues in the rest of chapter 1, and he describes how mankind willfully, on purpose, abandoned what they knew about God, gave it up, replacing him with other figments of their imagination that they called God in return. And with what result? Well, ultimately, that God abandoned them to their own garbage. He just let them be. He left them to their own desires. And if those went without check, which they did, that led them to every kind of embarrassing idolatry, not to mention a nicely paved road straight into the abyss. So Paul's first appeal to the Gentile world in Romans 1 is through creation. The next one in Romans 2 is through the fact that man made in the image of God. Man's part of the creation too. Well, God made him a certain way in that he has a conscience. Okay, the requirements of the law, without even ever slaying one single second of your eyes on any written material, are written on your heart, is what Paul says in Romans 2. No matter what you are, whether you're from Asia or whether you're a Jew or whether you are from Africa, it doesn't matter. So once again, Paul's not saying that every aspect of God's law can be deduced from the human conscience, or that your conscience is somehow a foolproof guide regarding correct modes of activity, or as far as what right is and what wrong is. But the conscience can be a guide, even though it's been severely damaged by sin. In fact, we know that people can even numb their own consciences by really just by ignoring it. You ignore your conscience long enough and it actually builds up a thick skin. You know, if you can just imagine your conscience as a callus or an item that is able to have a callus on it. But still, the apostle argues that the conscience can act as a guide in morality. So there's this universal law that is written on people's hearts. And that's what he says, for example, in chapter 2 and verse 15, okay? So based on those two verses in chapters 1 and 2, we can expect to be able to try to build some kind of a bridge to get a person to consider the gospel and become a Christian from both people's observations about the world, about true science, not fake science, as well as their innate sense of morality, their conscience. So we can construct arguments for God's existence from the recognition of design in nature and the experience of goodness and even things like guilt. Where does guilt come from, you see? How is it that anyone can be kind? What's the reason for that? It has to be noted that that Paul's primary concern in those first two chapters of Romans is with explaining how these two items, right, nature or creation and conscience, leave human beings without excuse. That's really his point. All right, the Bible's enough to condemn you, but right, let's grant it, you've never seen the Bible before. Here's two reasons why you're still going to go to hell: creation and conscience. Okay, and it justifies God's righteous judgment on all people, but it's still valid to conclude from what he says that those means, both of those, are within the realm of general revelation, okay, or natural revelation. Those two things are able to speak to people about the fact that they have a desperate need, okay, a need to know more about God and specifically the truth of the gospel, all right? Then the fifth one, 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3, 4, and 5. You'll notice verse 5, casting down imaginations. The idea there is demolishing arguments. Okay, here's a guy, he's got every conceivable reason why you're a fool to be going to church, and he's got all derogatory things to say about Christ and the Bible and church and everything else. And so casting down imaginations, demolishing those arguments, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringeth into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now in this context here, the 2 Corinthians 10 context, Paul's describing his ministry in terms of warfare that he is conducting against these spiritual strongholds that take the form of arguments and pretenses that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. So that provides a basis for, I remember we talked about defensive versus offensive apologetics. Defensive apologetics is when somebody wants to attack me or attack Christianity, and I defend that. Offensive apologetics is when I go to them and try to confront them with the gospel. All right. So that's what Paul's talking about here. The need for offensive apologetics. The sense is of actively storming the strongholds of the devil rather than taking a defensive position because someone's attacking me, all right? Even though it's likely that that will not be the task of every single believer. I think, guys like Greg Bonson and Van Til and these other geniuses, I mean, God maybe calls them to deal on that level, perhaps. But not everybody is going to be doing that. I know I certainly will not be doing that. But I think it's important to remember that apologetics is a spiritual enterprise, just as evangelism is. They're handmaidens. They go hand in hand with each other. And so we approach them prayerfully and with great care. The next grouping of scripture that shows another side of apologetics is Philippians 1, verses 7 and 16. Notice Paul speaks there, and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. Now, that's a two-sided coin. That's a coin with two sides on it. You'll recognize in Philippians that Paul is in prison because he's engaged in defending the gospel, according to verse 17. That's why he's in jail. And that process includes both defending and confirming the message. All right, so clearly, the apostle is engaging in both defensive and offensive apologetics. All right, that's why I gave you Philippians 1, 7, and 16. It shows both. Okay. And the purpose is to get someone pointed in the direction of the gospel, okay, or get them to even listen to it. So we don't separate apologetics from evangelism, right? You don't ever do apologetics just for itself, since the gospel that saves, not simply evidential and philosophical proofs of God's existence and Christ's historicity, right? We have to seek to try to lead people to right to the cross. That's the purpose for this. It's not about just winning arguments. Christ has made claims that are pertinent to their life. We need to get them to listen to those claims and then pray them right into a relationship with God. All right, then the last verse I gave you is 1 Peter 3, which has long been considered the anthem, the poster passage for this whole discipline. 1 Peter 3, verses 13 through 16. All right, so Peter does apologetics too, not just Paul. Notice verse 15. It says, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer." All right, there it is. Our word apologia. "Give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." So here's a passage that provides a firm basis for defensive apologetics, all right, because it deals with questions that might come up by various unbelievers, questions that people ask. And it also envisages believers providing answers to those who ask them why they have such a hope. So we have several key principles being enunciated here, right? What are they? Well, first, apologetics is the task of everyone. All right. Many have thought, you know, they've tried to pick up some literature and read it, or they try to attend a class like this. We're actually trying to dumb it down. It's hard to do because of the vocabulary, but apologetics is a task for everybody, every believer, not just the intellectual elite. Everybody should be prepared to give a defense of what they should of what they believe, at least defensive apologetics, if we're not going to take the offense. Secondly, arguments cannot be separated from the power of a lifestyle that would trigger a question to begin with, a provocative lifestyle in the good sense, okay? People ought to see our hope, and that would cause them to ask us about why it is we have that hope, spurned or spawned by our good behavior, which would make the strongest case for the truth that we're declaring. In other words, our life and lips should be in sync. Eager to do good, and that includes being eager to share our faith with others. All of that is in this verse, verse 15. Thirdly, our confidence comes from knowing that Christ is Lord. In fact, Peter's actually quoting, at least indirectly, Isaiah 8:12 in verse 14 of this passage. And it actually identifies Jesus as the Lord, Lord Almighty. And in fact, the point there is that fear of him is the antidote to the fear of man. And then fourthly, our attitude in engaging people should be humility and not just placing confidence in ourselves. Our confidence is in God, you see. And you see that with the word fear there. Fear of God, a healthy, trembling type of respect that occurs there in verse 15. Reverence, not respect for the people that ask, all right, or for their beliefs, although you're certainly going to show them respect. You can't be mean and nasty to them and expect them to listen to you, right? Although I think some people actually think that that's a prerequisite. It most certainly is not. I think even some of the books, they've missed the mark. They think that the objective is to win an argument. That is not the ultimate objective. It really isn't. See here, I found this on a website. Tell me what you think of this. It says it gives all this modus operandi and says it's designed to help you engage your neighbors with hard hitting throw down evidence as to why society cannot survive without Christian truth and why it is indeed true. It is vital that believers be equipped in the battle to defend Christian truth. Well, I may be exaggerating exactly what that author may have meant there, but we don't want to be into a knockdown, smackdown, you know, Friday night drag out war. That's not what we want. You know, I mean, it's difficult to see how that can be consistent with humility. And it doesn't just matter what you're saying, how you're saying it is also very important. You know, you've seen these preachers screaming at people from the pulpit, or the street preachers yelling. I mean, that is just, you automatically know nothing's going to happen. Absolutely nothing's going to happen. All right. I mean, the hard hitting should be the words of the gospel itself, or maybe possibly the apologetic truth designed to get them to look at the gospel. Maybe that might be hard hitting if it's used by the Holy Spirit appropriately. But we can't be hard hitting. And there's a difference. The thing that's hard-hitting is the power of the words of the gospel itself. Very, very important. Now, we don't want to deny that there's a spiritual battle going on. There absolutely is. But we also have to realize that the enemy is the spiritual forces of demons that bind and blind and ensnare people. In other words, the people are not our enemies. They may come off as enemies. They may actually try to be an enemy, but they actually are not enemies, because Ephesians 6 tells us that they're not enemies. We can use very powerful arguments without being, you know, in and of ourselves, the heavy hitters. Okay, and there's a difference. Kreeft and Tosselli say this: apologetic arguments are like military hardware. In this warfare, we defend reason as well as faith, for reason is the friend of truth, and unfaith is untrue. In defending the faith, we take back territory of the mind that is rightfully ours, or rather God's. But the warfare is against unbelief, not unbelievers. The goal of apologetics is not victory, it is the acquisition of truth. In other words, it's the one war where you actually want both sides to win. It's an excellent statement by Kreeft and Tosselli there. It's been missed by many, including independent Baptists. So this passage, 1 Peter 3:15 particularly, is the anthem for apologetics in the Bible. And it's not of course, I just showed you all these other places that are making points, but 1 Peter 3:15 helps us to overcome some of the natural barriers that a Christian can identify when he's thinking about evangelism and about using an apologetic method. Okay, what barriers? Well, like the interest level, which could be, you know, all over the place, and then my readiness to actually do something. All right, notice the interest level. Let's take on their part. Notice it says, "Every man that asketh you." Well, why are they asking? Why would they even ask? I must have been in a conversation. They must have been impressed with something about my life, or they wouldn't ask, unless they just want to fight. And if they wanted to fight, then they would be acting differently. But this passage is assuming they're asking a serious question that they want a real answer to, you see. So, and the question, it's not stated here, but the only reason that they would ask is because they're impressed with your life. They could see something's different about you, you see. And that provoked an interest in them. Or why else would they ask? All right. And then on our part, you know, notice it says, be ready always. Okay. That's what it says, right? Be ready always to give an answer. So we ought to have a desire to bless others by sharing our hope. And then a second barrier to evangelism or apologetics in 1 Peter 3:15 is the lack of distinctiveness. There has to be a consistency. Like, for example, in verse 16 of 1 Peter 3, the apostle there says, having a good conscience, that whereas they speak evil of you as of evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conversation in Christ. All right? So he talks there about having a good conscience and good conduct. That's what conversation means, the way I act. I have a clear conscience and a consistent life to back it up if I'm going to have confidence to actually disseminate information to a lost and dying world. So my actions matter. And that's right in the context in verse 16. Also my attitude. Okay. Be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. Okay. So we're ready to give an answer to every man that asketh you for a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and in fear. Because they're watching us. How do we react to the various challenges that life throws at us? Why are we different than them? And then there's a third barrier to apologetics or evangelism, and that's a lack of confidence or being afraid of something, all right? Afraid of what? Well, rejection. That's probably the major reasons why very few Christians engage in this, even though God commands it and it's completely not optional. All right? Instead of fearing rejection, notice in verse 15, you're to sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. All right? And if I do that, then I'm probably not going to be too afraid of man. So that becomes a big issue. Who am I afraid of? Am I afraid of man or am I afraid of God? And that matters. So I have a lack of confidence. I fear rejection. I'm afraid of getting it wrong, either in my attitude or in something I might say. And that's why at the end of verse 15, this is to be done in meekness and humility. Okay? So every word of verse 15 is critical to the process. I'm doing it in meekness. That's restrained power. In fear, that means I'm under control. I have reverence for God, and I'm doing it because of that. I don't want to get it wrong. Okay? I don't have to have all of the answers because I don't. I just need to be able to pray that God will use something that I've said that will point them to the gospel, because that's where the power is. And that's where Christ is in the gospel, not ourselves. Okay. Now let's begin in number 7, the dynamic of an apologetic dialogue. Apologetics may happen at many different levels, from very highly formally trained intellectual debates with leading atheist thinkers, presentations in universities, debates within Parliament in England, something like that, to the highly informal and the very less intellectual, like the books by Josh McDowell and Lee Strobel, and stuff like that. Okay? So I want to focus here, in the minutes we have left, on this more informal interaction, on how every single Christian, regardless of our ability, should be willing and expect to engage in the normal process as it's described in 1 Peter chapter 3. All right? One of the leading contemporary apologists, his name is Michael Ramsden. He has a website, bethinking.org. You might want to check that out, bethinking.org. He warns, and I'm quoting him here, the temptation with apologetics is to offer set answers to set questions. In other words, I drill. He may ask me this. All right, now, then out of my file, I pull out this answer, and that matches that question, you see. So he's saying, you got to watch out for that. That's not the way it should be. It can be useful to have a structure in mind when dealing with certain issues. However, it's better to have an understanding of how we can effectively engage with people at a conversational level. Apologetics can become mechanical. Although the truth of the gospel remains constant, we mustn't think that by repeating things we have said to other people in the past that we will automatically get the same response from the guy that we meet next week. Because everybody's different. The thing that may have tipped the scales for you would never tip the scales for you. Every scenario and every situation and every person is different. That the message doesn't change, but how you get there may be different. So can we learn anything about the dynamics of conversation with a non-believer from 1 Peter 3, let's say 13 through 16? Based on that passage, and based on personal experience, I think we can consider the constituent parts of a proper interaction. All right, so let's see if we can go through this and get through as much of it as we can. First, the context for an apologetic interchange. The context in which that takes place is vital to how the conversation is going to go. Okay? And that works on a number of levels. Like, what is the nature of the relationship between you and the person you're talking to? How well do you know this person? Because the nature of your relationship, or lack of such, that's going to affect the way you interact and how direct and how deep you feel you want to go. And that dynamic will be extremely different if you're speaking with, let's say, a very close relative. I'm not going to speak the same way with a very close relative as that has never loved God at all, as opposed with a lifetime Christian friend, okay, or a neighbor, or just a casual acquaintance that I barely know, or somebody from work, or a person that I just met. You know, I met him in a restaurant and we sparked a conversation. So I need to be aware of what's my relationship with this person. And then secondly, the immediate situation, all right, depending on where am I? What place am I in? Am I in a library? Am I out in a ball game? I mean, where am I? The time, the social setting that I'm in. Depending on those things, I may have a greater or a lesser freedom to talk at length and at a more personal level. So I want to consider the difference between what I might be able to do or not do in a crowded room, okay, or just me and somebody else being alone in a living room, or the difference of what can happen perhaps at a big, giant social gathering versus the aftermath of a funeral, for example. And then I want to thirdly consider the wider context. Every interaction happens within a wider social, cultural, historical context. All right? Conversations can be much freer in an open democracy, like we have here in America, compared to being in Siberia or China. Okay? I mean, there might be something in the news that could be a catalyst that will spark a conversation and that will likely inform and shape the way the conversation unfolds. Different cultures will appreciate and permit different degrees of either total informality or more directness because cultures are different. Now, you're not compromising, you're just being all things to all men. You're trying to adapt yourself to that culture as long as there's no sin involved. And where the social and the cultural gap is greater between the two parties, then that requires even greater sensitivity on my part if I'm the one with the gospel. Okay? So I need to be aware of the context for the interchange. All right? What's my relationship with this guy? What situation am I in right now? And what's the broader context? All right, then, as far as I'm concerned, let's say I'm the apologist or you're the apologist. A hope-filled person that fears no one but Christ and is living out their conversation, their good behavior, for everybody to see and doing that with a clear conscience. All right, that's hopefully the case with us. My personal story is the greatest apologetic device I possibly can have. That's why every single one of you should have your testimony polished, be able to give a reason for the hope in you. That's giving of your testimony. If you cannot give a testimony, why can you not do that? God expects you to be able to do that, and you're not off. He's not going to let you off the hook. Your testimony is the most powerful thing that you have, besides the gospel itself. You tell it with humility, you tell it with sincerity, and it's very, very hard to argue because it's your story. It's a good form of existentialism. It's your experience, and which no one can take away from you. You did it. You experienced it. You may feel that you're not the best person to be dealing with a certain question that may have been raised, or I'm not the guy to deal with that person, but you're the person that's there right now. You see, God put you in that situation right now, and you've got to trust that the situation hasn't arisen because of some coincidence. There is no such thing as coincidence. So you have to believe and have the courage and faith in God and have the kind of life with Christ that believes that you're able to bear witness to the Lord at that very moment, even though you might not think that you're the guy for the job, you see. You approach the conversation with confidence in God, but with, at the same time, humility regarding your own ability and your own understanding of the other person. And again, I find Kreeft and Tosselli very helpful. They give a necessary warning about the importance of the person of the apologist when you're having a dialogue with an unbeliever. They say, an argument in apologetics, when actually used in dialogue, is an extension of the arguer. The arguer's tone, sincerity, care, concern, listening ability, and respectfulness matter as much as his or her logic, and probably more. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Now, with regard to the questioner, we consider who is the person that's speaking with us. What's his cultural background? What's his religious background? What experience does he have that might lie behind his question? Or what's coloring the perspective that he has on Christianity? Where do they stand as regards to, are they hostile? Are they indifferent? Are they interested? Are they being challenged? Or they say, oh, I used to do that. They're former believers. Or are they just having a hard time? They're struggling with massive doubt. All those things are important because depending on where they are on those scales, that's the kind of approach, apologetic approach you want to use based on where they're at, you see. It's also worth considering at that point, what point in the gospel they're stuck at. There'll be five places that they'll be stuck. First of all, is there a God at all? Now, that's the worst condition. Does God even exist? Is there actually such a thing as a single creator? And then what's his character? I mean, if he does exist, is he good? Is he bad? What is he? Or they'll be stuck, secondly, on the problem of sin. They either don't believe in it, I'm not that bad, you know. Do I really have a need of God? Can't I live without God? They don't understand sin. That's a problem. So you got to help them in that area. And then the next issue will be the person of Christ. All right. Was there really a historical Jesus? That's one of the easier things to deal with. There's more evidence for Christ, friends. There's more evidence that Jesus Christ walked the earth than there is that George Washington walked the earth. Do you realize that? There's more evidence for Christ. That's an easy one. And then his work. Why did he die? Did he actually really rise again from the dead? And then that becomes an apologetic. Or they may be past those three things, and they're right at the point of conversion. All right? So what can I say to them, or how can I act, or what apologetic can I use to get them to the point where they will actually believe? You see, that's the goal. Or you can have someone who says they're a Christian. They may not be, but they say they're a Christian. They have absolutely no assurance whatsoever. They're doubting that they're Christians at all. So are they confident in God's salvation? Are they assured in his love? Okay. All right, that's all we can do for tonight. Now, I gave you in your PACS, it says apologetic strategies and evangelistic encounters. Do you have that in your PACS? Let's just take a peek at that, and then we'll be finished. See, there's four columns. This is the paper I'm talking about. All right, and column number one, the stance regarding the faith. I'm either disinterested or I'm ignorant. Well, I didn't go over with a fine-tooth comb what fideism is, a faith approach, but that's the approach you want to use. All right, I'm apathetic, or I don't know anything. All right. In other words, their attitude is, it doesn't matter to me if God exists or not. And then what you want to try to help them with, your apologetic wants to get them this way. If God exists, it absolutely matters. And you're putting that in their mind. And maybe the Holy Spirit will use that to get them to consider the scriptures. You see, maybe, maybe not. Or I'm skeptical. All right, well, the Reformed pattern, the Reformed apologetic might work there, all right? This guy says, God's real to you, all right, that's cool for you. He's not. God's not real to me, all right? but the Reformed approach tries to convince the guy, listen, you do a lot of things by faith every day. Don't tell me faith doesn't matter, because it does. You live by faith every day, you just don't think about it. And maybe that'll trigger something, okay? Or they're just totally confused. The confused person needs classical apologetics, which we're going to do next. That's the next class. We'll start classical apologetics. Okay? How do you know that there's a God? Well, the evidence points to it. I might use the evidential approach, all right? Or I could use the classical approach, which basically will let them think that there's no other view. No other worldview out there makes any sense, and show them why, okay? Or they have objections. I'm going to use evidentialism or classical apologetics, or they're feeling challenged, or they have these doubts, okay? So there's different approaches that we can use depending on what their problem is, okay? All right. I am glad that we're done with that. Now, we're really not done with it, but we are going to be done with it. And